This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'm reading again from Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002 by Henry Holt and Company. This reading starts out talking about the molt these birds go through. And I realized I've never tackled talking about molt in birds. It's incredibly complex. A person could spend their lifetime studying molt patterns in just a few species of birds. And so I thought I would look at the Cornell website, All About Birds, which is a free website. If you love birds, you'll really enjoy what All About Birds has to offer, allaboutbirds.org. Cornell's really done a terrific job there. So I looked up molt, and I thought I'd read a little bit of it to you. And here's what it says, the basics about feather molt. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll just give you the highlights. A feather is a dead structure, analogous to hair or nails in humans, and made of the same basic ingredient, the protein keratin. This means that when they get damaged, feathers can't heal themselves. They have to be completely replaced. This replacement of all or some of the feathers is called molt. In addition to providing a new set of healthy feathers, molts often provide a new look to the bird's plumage, new colors or patterns that can indicate the bird's age, sex, or the seasons of the year. Molt is extremely variable. Observed patterns can vary by species, by individual, from year to year, and by individual feathers on the same bird. Molts can be either complete, in which the bird replaces every one of its feathers over the same molt period, or partial, in which the bird replaces only some of its feathers, for example, flight feathers or body feathers. I'll interrupt here and say that I remember going to a conference when I was a bird rehabilitator, and one of the paper sessions where the people put up posters of their work. I walked into a room and saw this detailed poster after poster after poster of the molt. I think it was a golden eagle. I know it was a large raptor. And from year to year, they were studying slight changes in the molt patterns of this bird with photographs. Some feathers become more pale because they're exposed to sunlight for longer, and a newer feather looks darker right next to it because it's been molted recently. And there's so many feathers on a bird's body that if all of this isn't happening in a complete molt, it's happening over a period of years. They're aging birds by these complex methods of analyzing molt. I remember feeling like I was way over my head looking at that exhibit. The Cornell All About Birds on Molt goes on to say, molt keeps birds in top flying condition by replacing feathers that have become worn or damaged with completely new feathers. If a bird loses an entire feather, that feather will begin growing back immediately rather than waiting for the next molt. This is why people clip the flight feathers of captive birds rather than plucking them out. Molting occurs in response to a mixture of hormonal changes brought about by seasonal changes. The entire process is complex, and many questions remain regarding how the process is controlled. A basic understanding of molting patterns can be a useful aid in identifying many species and in determining their age. And under timing, it says it takes a lot of energy to build new feathers. As a result, timing is important. And birds typically time their molts to avoid other periods of high energy demand, such as nesting or migration. Molt timing can be more complicated for larger birds because growing larger feathers means that their molt process takes longer than it does for smaller birds. This is one reason why some birds undergo partial molts. And I'll interrupt again and say that I spend a lot of time watching red tails flying around, and I always like to observe whether they've started molting around the time when they're young fledge. And also turkey vultures, when they get here in the spring, they're always completely feathered and you don't see any gaps in their wings. And then very shortly after summer starts and starts to get warmer, you'll start noticing gaps in their wing feathers. And it's kind of fun to pay attention to turkey vultures, especially because there are so many around. And you can see what part of the molt they're in. How often do birds molt? This varies by species, but almost all birds fall into one of three categories. One complete molt per year. Examples include chickadees, flycatchers, hawks, hummingbirds, jays, owls, swallows, thrushes, vireos, and woodpeckers. And then one complete molt and one partial molt before the breeding season. Birds in this group, such as buntings, tanagers, and warblers, molt all their feathers after nesting and assume their basic plumage. Then, before the next breeding season, they have a partial molt of their body feathers that gives the males their bright alternate breeding plumage. Though females don't typically molt into bright plumage, they do go through this same partial molt. Did you know this about bobolinks? Two complete molts per year. Only a few species undergo two full molts per year. Most of these live in areas where the environment causes significant feather wear and tear. Marsh wrens and bobolinks, two species that move through abrasive vegetation, are examples. These birds have a complete molt into basic plumage and another complete molt into alternate plumage. While marsh wrens don't look very different from winter to summer, male bobolinks change from brown and streaky to a bold black and cream alternate plumage. And then I think last week I mentioned goldfinches go through two molts a year too. If they're at our feeders, we can notice that very clearly. I also wanted to talk a little more about Carl Safina. I'll read from the Wiki site. He was born in 1955, and he has written many books and many articles, which you can look up, I hope, or find at the library. He received a degree in environmental science at the State University of New York at Purchase, and later at Rutgers University, he earned master's and PhD degrees in ecology for his studies of seabirds. So I will start now reading from Carl Safina, Eye of the Albatross. We're back on Turn Island in the French Frigate Shoals. Anthony says he needs to check some of his birds, so I volunteered to assist him. Anthony has worked here for several years, including a stint as manager of the place. He's now 30 and a graduate student at the University of Washington. Anthony's research is an attempt to understand the black-footed albatross's threshold for taking a year off from breeding in order to grow new feathers, and how the members of the pair stay synchronized over skipped years. He's trying to predict who will return next year by examining how worn out their feathers are. The large flight feathers of albatross wings bear more microscopic frills on their interlocking barbules than any other known feathers. That toughens them, but they still take an extraordinary beating from the punishing winds, the sun, and salt water. Anthony explains, feathers are either new and shiny chocolate brown, or what I call class 2, which are duller and slightly worn, or class 3, which are bleached lighter and brown and brittle, with edges very frayed. The 6th and 7th primary flight feathers seem to take a beating. They're a strong indicator of where the bird is in its molt process, unquote. Anthony can look at a bird's wing and say things like, looks like it replaced these 4 feathers last year and did a full molt the year before that. Ultimately, as he explains, understanding how many years albatrosses actually breed is the only way to understand their lifetime reproductive potential. Anthony has short black hair, clean-cut features, an earring in each ear. Trying to minimize disturbance, we come and go from each nest as quickly as possible. Anthony, checking one band, says, oops, got that one already. We didn't need to disturb that bird again. His discomfort with causing disturbance to the birds is further evidence of a new generation of kinder, gentler biologists. Kinder, gentler, and more physically fit. No beer bellies here. Even after hours of working outdoors, these people run laps, ride a bike, play basketball. One person jumps rope daily for half an hour. Assistant manager Mark even does some gymnastics. After the evening run, they pop in a workout video, and the floor gets crowded with young interns following the exercises while the chef du jour prepares dinner for the entire crew. Tonight is Mark's turn to cook, but before dinner he's taking a break up on the roof, watching the world slow spin, scanning the ocean, looking for whales through a telescope. I climb the ladder to join him. Mark, 33, has been a national park ranger in the Everglades and in Hawaii. Mark's mother is a social worker, his father a country lawyer. So I guess I was never destined for business. Who I am all stems from growing up in a tiny town on Mississippi Delta marshes. I love being a part of nature, knowing the atoms in my bones are from fish I caught growing up in the Delta. At 11, I had my own boat, and I was free in that Delta wilderness, that joy. We're losing that area now. I wonder what happens to kids living their childhoods there today. But this, Mark says, opening his arms to include all of French Frigate Shoals, is fun, he turns to me. More and more I realize I want what I had growing up, to be surrounded by wilderness, working outside, my body feeling the pulse of nature. When I worked in the Everglades, if the water dropped a quarter inch, you'd notice the birds and alligators' behavior changes. I like living where your body and mind are tuned to what's happening. I love cities and fancy restaurants, too, but it's a blast to be in a place like this. Mark resumes scanning the sea through the telescope, talking as he's searching. "Hey, breaching whale!" Mark calls down from the roof to some of the others. "I've got the spotting scope on it," he yells as people are coming up the ladder. I swing my binoculars up. The humpback's spouts look like a white flag waving truce in the sunset. Soon, six people are up on the roof taking turns at the telescope. The whale lurches out in a half-twisting jump, big explosions erupting as he crashes back into the sea. You don't need a telescope to see that. The whale comes for three big breaches, four. We're all cheering. The whale rolls and slaps the water with its long pectoral fin. Through my binoculars, I watch his gigantic head and half his massive body launch in slow motion, turn sideways, and make a big belly flop, detonating tremendous ocean commotion. From the high tide of the heart, the mouth speaks. Mark shouts to the whole blue universe, "You are beautiful!" Today, truly, this is a gracious place, rife with persistent life, noisy, smelly, all full of the stinking, fluttering, bustling hustle of muscle, corpuscle, and tendon. Let us shout with the pleasure and intensity of it. Behold the real, real world. 4 billion years in the making, still trying its best to get it right, brimming with vivid power. Not a bad pauhana, Mark adds. I look at him questioningly. He explains, "Pau means done, hana means workday. Pauhana, happy hour." In late afternoon, the sooty terns that have, for hours, been twisting overhead in swelling flocks begin touching down like a broad tornado funnel cloud, a storm of wings, a conflagration of voices building to a screaming white noise cyclone of sound. By sunset, the sooty tern's collective voices begin to roar like fierce wind, like some physical force. The birds begin landing, but time and again, a sudden intensification of their calls accompanies a mass liftoff, as though the birds all decide, let's not land after all. Perhaps the idea of committing themselves to firm ground after months or years at sea seems so unfamiliar and terrifying a prospect that almost anything can prompt a general alarm. Perhaps there is simply some other sense of liberty or fear in their minds that rejects forsaking the free sea for the arduous ardor of breeding that will leash their lives to the land. But land they do, just after dark, part of the runway is absolutely crammed with sooties. We're enveloped amid birds and their wall of sound. The sheer volume of their yakkering is absolutely deafening. painful. You can't take this much noise for long. It's hard to imagine how the birds themselves can stand it. As Mark prepares to cook dinner, Anthony and Karen volunteer to make an appetizer for everyone. Franz has bread in the oven. The military-sized kitchen is dominated by hanging pots and pans, as well as a big, festively painted ocean mural featuring frolicking stingrays, colorful reef fishes, sea turtles, a monk seal, albatrosses, a large tiger shark, frigate birds, and flying fish. Thousands of years ago, cave-dwelling peoples painted images of surrounding wildlife on their walls. And in this cavernous kitchen, it's clear human nature has not changed. We still decorate with reference and reverence to nature. Painters, potters, sculptors, and fabric designers do not create decorative images of cell phones and computers. No one paints murals of executives in board meetings discussing votes on mergers. Art tends to reflect what we really care about, our true delights and frights. Art has a fairly good sense of human nature. It's a pretty honest broker of subjective human truths. When new parents anticipate the arrival of a child, they decorate the baby's room with elephants and striped tigers and rainbowed parrots and festive fishes and other animals. This speaks volumes of our wish to welcome our cherished children into a world rich in the company of other beings, of the true deep importance of animals in our psyche. Of all the many good reasons to defend animals' existence, this alone seems reason enough. If we let the world finally lose its wild elephants and tigers and parrots, as we are doing, wouldn't it be unbearably sad to ever again paint them on the nursery walls? Mark cooks a delicious vegetarian meal, responding to compliments. He reveals his secret. This recipe was, look only at the date and cook what's oldest. The salt and pepper shakers on the long dining table are incongruous porcelain snowmen. The oil lamps bring dinner conversation to low and intimate tones. We talk about the day's work and the changes in the animals. With the different stages of reproduction, there's plenty to talk about. Fairy terns and red-tailed tropic birds hatching, albatrosses with growing chicks, red-footed and masked boobies, both hatching and on eggs, brown and black noddies, some with chicks, some still incubating, great frigate birds courting, sooty terns now nesting, turtles on the beach, someone seen a large shark near shore. Missing from mealtime are the monk seal researchers. They tend to begin early, work late, and eat together even later. But we don't lack for extra company. During dinner, a black noddy flies through one door across the big room and out another open door. A little later, as we're cleaning up, a fairy tern comes in like the Holy Ghost, fluttering and hovering. Interestingly, its flight is not the mad dash of a bird feeling trapped. Anthony escorts it outside into the night. I walk out with him and then linger when he goes inside. The darkness seems to be intensifying the bird's racket into a great roaring bonfire of voices. The night air carries the guttural grunts and honks of boobies, the brays and bill claps of the albatrosses, the murmurs of the noddies and the sooty terns, squeaky, I'm wide awake, wide awake. The air also carries the unabated scent of nesting seabirds. A bird colony gives off a certain pungent, powdery sort of smell. It's pleasant to me because it evokes the nostalgia of the days working on splendid island beaches with cherished friends and colleagues. Jason and Mary, two of the seal researchers, appear and join me. While I'm getting sentimental over the eau de guano, Jason confides that he doesn't like the birdie stench. Instead, he loves the stink of seals because he's studied them for years and has developed a fondness for everything about them. Beauty is in the nostril of the beholder. We turn our biased noses toward the heavens. The night unlocks. The sky unfolds like a jewelry box. From the diamond expanse of space, I pick out Orion, my favorite constellation, a point of reference not only in space but in my life. Orion's presence makes me feel at home no matter where I am. Why do we think of only the night sky as the heavens? Why not the day? And why heavens, plural? Jason knows much more about the stars than I do, and he orients us to the sky. There's Orion, yes, the Orion Nebula, Sirius, the Andromeda Galaxy's saucer-like pugmark in far space, the Pleiades, or Makalii, little eyes, who tied all humankind's food in a net and hung it in the heavens until the rat god gnawed the ropes, letting the food tumble back to Earth. Jupiter, with two of its moons visible through binoculars. Jupiter's moons have lovely names, Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. These are the Galilean moons, discovered by Galileo himself in 1610 and named after mythological lovers of the god Jupiter. Amalthea, Leda, Himalaya, Lysithea, Elara, Ananke, Carmi, Pasiphae, and Sinope. What does it say of us that we have not afforded our own lone moon the full acknowledgement of a name? We appreciate the distant more than the close at hand. We see a man in our moon, yet we keep him anonymous. No wonder that in his frozen orbit he reflects light with bright intensity, yet maintains a dark side. Two meteors and two satellites, sooty terns are flying constantly overhead among the immense density of stars. All this noise and noisomeness and vibrancy makes it feel as if the lens of the living Pacific has focused on this dot of sand and on us. I'll stop there. If you're enjoying this program, all of my programs are archived at WDRT.org. All of the previous Albatross programs and all the various topics I've covered over the years. Thank you, WDRT. This is Maggie Jones. I've been reading Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina. Thank you for listening.